everyone, and welcome to Playwright, a podcast about creating and sharing new ways to play. My name is Ryan Heyman, you can call me H, and venturing back from the land of the dead is our good friend, Ryan Quintel.
You can call me Sam Fisher.
Or Sam Elliott.
Sam Elliott. But I'm a
all
secret
Sams, agent. Except for Sam I Am, probably. It's not the voice that I would have given that character.
I work for 6th or 7th echelon or 11th echelon. I don't remember the echelon that I work for. I work with Lambert. I wish I could do a real, now I can't even think of the name, Michael Ironside voice. What a set of pipes on that guy. And when I have an illness, like I recently was befallen, thank you for trudging through and having our wonderful guest on last week. I appreciate that. I've always wanted a deeper voice, and yet I'm stuck with this kind of energetic-y, peppy, higher voice that hopefully suits me, but... yeah, I get to dabble in it when I'm sick.
Yeah, well, maybe we can pull some of that as part of the inspiration for what we're going to be doing here today. Maybe there's some sort of maybe you kind of get back in touch with your manly man roots.
This is a gritty reboot of this show. It's the
sounds about right.
This is not the cue you remember. Oh, no. Oh. I'll try and keep all of the coughing off mic, but you can leave one in so the audience understands the gravity of the situation.
Just to understand what's at stake, right?
Yeah, right. This is a life or death podcast.
All right. Let's go ahead and get to the video game pitches.
It's probably me first, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose you go first today.
This is the least I can do. Okay. I want to pitch to you a game where you are on an adventure. Maybe it has some light role-playing elements, but you have to communicate, and things are communicated to you entirely in emoji. And you can go around trying to solve puzzles for people, but they speak in emoji, and you can communicate back in very limited emoji, but you have a camera, and you can kind of go around the environment taking photos of things at just the right angle to create little iconized versions of them, little emoji versions of different objects in the world, and add those to your emoji library. And then you get new ways of communicating, but also new clues to solve the puzzles that people want your help with on this adventure.
Let's go and start the clock on that one. So this is interesting. I guess I'll just I'll come out and I'll say the parts that I really like, and then we can kind of work through some of the parts I'm still having trouble with.
Hate.
I don't hate anything about
it. Okay, I appreciate it.
I think there are some parts I am gravitating more towards than the other parts. So I really like the idea of going around this island and taking pictures of things, and then those pictures kind of becoming emojis. It kind of has that Pokemon Snap kind of recognition of what's in the picture. You have to get a good picture of whatever it is that you're shooting for it to translate into an emoji. What I don't understand is what kind of puzzles are you solving? Other like you're trying to communicate with the villagers. I get that you're maybe perhaps kind of commodifying these emojis and creating. There's an economic desire for emojis that people are willing to pay for.
Oh,
so,
interesting.
But like what kind of puzzles are you solving? A mystery? Are you some sort of detective? Like what is the rest of the framing of this?
Well, we could certainly go there. I mean, it is Playwright and we haven't hit our detective quota for the episode yet, but I do like the idea of, when you're taking the photos, say Pokemon Snap style, you have to wait for your moment in a sense, like maybe, or you have to get an angle where your emoji scanner only emojifies when it sees an object or something on a solid background. So you have to catch, a bug in the sky or a bird. You have to get down low and shoot it kind of against a backdrop or a plain sky rather than landing on a bush or something that's a little bit more complex because your scanner can't quite capture it. In terms of puzzle solving, I was thinking that you could do more in this environment than just take pictures. Maybe you have more of a portal-like amount of mobility and agency where you can kind of pick things up and push buttons and navigate around somewhere between the speed of a portal and maybe a witness sort of thing. So it's not too fast, but you can kind of move around the environment at an interesting clip and potentially relocate things, discover new paths, new hidden areas. But maybe you're right. Maybe instead of having NPCs, instead you create a witness-like island and you show like glyphs on different doors and different bulkheads and different things. And now your job is to go and photograph the proper emoji in order to unlock those different pathways or those different switches. And it's more the entire island itself is a puzzle that you're constantly on, like a giant interactive I Spy.
You know, one game I wanted to bring into this is a little indie gem from last year published by Humble Bundle, I think, called A Short Hike, which is a really lovely little game. It's it's kind of a miniature Breath of the Wild. You know, it was described on the end of the year show where you play this little crow who is trying to get to the top of this mountain, and all of these tasks that you can perform for the villagers throughout the island grant you more gold feathers. And those gold feathers are just like meters that allow you to climb higher and to glide further. And so it's kind of like, you know, Breath of the Wild stamina meters in that way. So all these little side quests that you can choose to complete or ignore make it a little bit easier for you to climb a bit higher and get to that next, you know, point where there are more villagers, where there's, you know, more things to do, more things to jump and glide to. It's a really nice game. It probably takes an hour or two to play, but it's a really lovely experience. Maybe you are a professional emoji photographer, and there's kind of a hierarchy of missing items from the emoji keyboard. Maybe you are working for a phone manufacturer that just started up and they can't use any of the Android or iPhone official emojis. They have to come up with their own set. And so you're going around the island, you're photographing all these kind of, you know, normal, banal things. And then you can see up on the list, there are very specific things that you need to photograph. And, you know, you don't see them around you. And so you can either, you know, sell the emojis that you are able to, photograph to get upgrades to your platforming ability so that you can kind of make it to different parts of the island. Or you could, we mentioned Pokemon Snap earlier as well. You can find certain ways to kind of trick the algorithm of putting an object behind another object to make it look like dragonfly wings behind the body of a dragonfly, you know, like that, like something to kind of fool it into thinking you actually photographed a much more expensive and much more rare item than you really did.
That's interesting. So now you get one of those. It's almost, you see this in mobile games too, where those things where you kind of find the right angle of it. And then you
like
get
a perspective puzzle.
Yeah. The perspective puzzle, I think, is a cool angle to take with this. And then you're fulfilling. And now you just are dealing with like the emoji silhouettes. But I think one of the things that is still compelling, and tell me if it's, I think it's compatible with what you're talking about, is the sort of analog control of moving around this tropical island. Maybe it's tropical. I mean, maybe it's, there's all sorts of different biomes across it, but moving across this island and discovering things in a very sort of manual analog catching things. And it would kind of encourage the eye that a real photographer has to have, right? And Pokemon Snap almost got there, which is like, in a moment, can you very quickly go, hey, you know, it almost catches the corner of your eye to see something at a particular angle.
If you miss a particular snap, I guess that's not the end of the world. You know, maybe if there's like one or two that you're waiting for and having to kind of sit around for the cycle to reset, you know, the bullet train or something like that, where it might be 5 minutes in between the trains coming. That could get a little annoying, but I would think that would make it more satisfying. And then throughout the rest of the game, you you don't have to sit around waiting for that butterfly to come back. You could just go off and start photographing other things. And if you see a butterfly later, then great, you know, go and capture that.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about that is now you can enter into a situation too where potentially behind or to pull a lever or something, you have to have like access to three different emoji. And once you have them, you can always bang in the code. And so I'm like smiley, honeypot, and bee. And then as that is created, or as that thing triggers, maybe it drops a piece of fruit. And you know, okay, I can go take this fruit and like put it somewhere near this like iguana cove, and I can get one of them to come out to eat it. And how you're positioning that object and the fruit of it sets you up for success. So you can kind of set up your own shots as well, which is very sort of Pokemon Snap-esque.
Are there any aspects of competition against other photographers or any multiplayer aspects that you would want to bring to this?
I do like the idea of photographers working together. I wonder if you could link up a camera feed with a friend, and if both of you trigger a shutter at an agreed upon time, and maybe there's a way to automate it, but you know, you and I, 3, 2, 1 snap, and you get a double exposure. And so we could be in two different areas photographing two different things, but because of the double exposure, it kind of composes into that silhouette.
All right. We're just about out of time on that one. Let's go ahead and close it down and come up with a name for this game.
I wrote this down. It's not a word. It could be, though. Emojinary.
Emojinary. So it's like a dictionary of emoji?
Yeah. Or imaginary.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it kind of works in both the... both avenues, I feel.
I see. Of course, I go to the more boring response right off the bat.
The man dreams of dictionaries. Nothing wrong with that.
It's like a dictionary. All right. Emojinary. I like that. Oh, that's a good one now that it really hit me. All right. My pitch for the day is you must economically manage the Star Wars universe as the Empire.
Oh.
Decide how much you want to micromanage each planet to extract taxes, crack down on crime, or let crime flourish and take bribes. You can choose how to use the money. Do you build a Death Star? Do you invest in the planet's infrastructure and ecosystems? Do you let each planet's government rule itself with minimal oversight? Or do you rule with an iron fist? So... I was really inspired by the conversations that they were having on the Death Star in the first Star Wars movie right before that one unfortunate idiot in the Empire started mouthing off to Darth Vader, you know,
you would do well to forget your ancient religions, how well it's done to capture the Rebel Alliance so far.
It's so uncanny.
Come on. You're just asking for it at this point. You know.
Yeah,
this
right.
is Darth Vader.
Yeah, that dude's getting choked out.
But anyways, they were discussing before about how, you know, the Death Star allows them some extent of oversight without having to deploy people and manpower on each of the planets. Let all the planets kind of govern themselves, but with the threat of basically planetary annihilation looming over them if they step out of line. So I was curious if there are other ways to take those economic decisions. Ruling an entire galaxy is an unimaginable task. So let's start the clock there and see what we can do to take this in different directions.
I love this idea. It's I'm surprised I didn't come to it at some point. But the football manager version of managing an empire, because managing an empire must be quite mundane in many aspects of it. But I love the idea of just having, you know, the galactic map and being able to kind of highlight things and treat it almost like as a civilization thing. And so you're choosing to do things like upgrade security on planets and station troops on there, and maybe station stationing troops in, this was a mechanic, I think, in like Civ 4. If you station some, people feel protected. If you station too many, people feel threatened. And so like the productivity of that planet kind of starts to tank. So you get this delicate balance of, I believe Princess Leia said, the tighter you squeeze, the more systems will slip through your fingers. So, mm-hmm. You almost want to manage your evil empire with kind of a light hand, potentially, to be economically successful.
Yeah. So, what does that mean that the planets will slip through the fingers? You know, how does that actually manifest? Is it just driving more people towards the rebellion, or are there other ways in which you can fail by, you know, keeping too tight of a grip?
That's a good question. So I think what you're trying to optimize, right, is like theoretically a planet that is under Empire rule, all of that planet's like profit and or resources must also go directly to the Empire. So the Empire, you know, we have a large fleet of ships. It must take a lot of food and power to keep all of these 10 million Star Destroyers up and about. The idea of being able to see how different planets are contributing to your resource allocation and then kind of macroing your micro, as they say, and have like... economic production is up, and really the only reason an empire would even care about morale at all, because it really sort of it's only a means to the end of control, and control is just for resources. I wonder if like you get down to like installing empire lackeys in local governments and that level of control.
You have to imagine that the number of people that you can really trust and that are really dependable must be a limited resource as well.
Yeah, I think it's, I like the idea of betrayal and finding out that some of your planets have actually been like siphoning off resources or potentially feeding you false information. And so you have to send like inquisitors to different planets to like check and see if they're being honest about their outputs. And that's like a risk reward sort of thing. We're sending an inquisitor. It can be something that like turns a planet's government against you because mm-hmm. they're sort of very forceful and very intimidating. You know, it also, it's like taking a role, right? And the other side of the coin is that that planet becomes more productive because potentially they redoubled their efforts, as they say on the Death Star, to get you more out of without creating any burden of like additional support from you.
I think another aspect of Star Wars that makes it interesting is that you also have to factor in the magical elements of it on both ends. So potential Jedi that are opposing you, maybe you have to choose whether or not to initiate Order 66 or whatever it was to wipe out all the Jedi, or maybe there's only a handful of Jedi left that have survived, and you know, it's up to you to either track them down or just kind of let them be and assume they're not going to be a problem, or maybe try to operate the galaxy in a just and respectful way that would not incur their wrath if they do choose to rise up. You know, maybe you treat everyone so well enough, there is no rebellion.
One small administration note that is worth addressing in the, did you see the latest Star Wars movie?
Yep.
Order 67 is the order that the Emperor gives. I need to know what the first 65 orders were, because
and the fact that there were zero orders between episodes 3 and episode 9.
Right, exactly. No additional orders were given while he was running the entire show, which is very strange. Or maybe only the big ones get the numbers. The rest of them were just your run-of-the-mill orders.
I was kind of disturbed during that movie thinking, like, where is he getting the money? And... because like they spoke in the original trilogy about how like the economic impact of building a Death Star, and like this is a huge expenditure, and like, you know, nobody could possibly build a building or a planet sized space station. You know, only the Empire has that kind of money. But then you got the sense that it's like the Empire has just that amount of money. And it's like then you know, we get to episode 9 and they're just like, it's just some backwoods kind of a planet in the middle of nowhere with this dude that doesn't even have a valid credit card or social security number any longer is somehow just given unlimited resources to build his army in whatever way he chooses.
It was implied that he was able to summon the ships and like, so wait a minute, the Emperor can like make steel and like cafeterias and shit out of thin air? That seems crazy.
Was that the implication? I missed that.
I think so. I think it was like he's been conjuring up this fleet. Maybe that was just an allusion to like he's been acquiring it somehow. But the yeah, like most J.J. Abrams movie works, it kind of like sounds good in the moment. And then like the next day you're like, what just happened? That's a great mechanic potentially in this game is that as you level up or you progress as the Empire, you get access to orders 1 through 65. And those are all like special events that you can execute on like planetary or system based bases that give you economic bonuses, or it's almost like an epoch changeover or something in Civ where you have the opportunity to like create a new set of orders and values that people are guaranteed to follow over so many turns. Maybe, you know, maybe this is a turn based thing.
I think this could be a really interesting, I don't want to use the term immersive sim because that means something else, but just to use them as adjectives and descriptors for it to be a simulation that there are some games where you can really kind of drill into one facet of one planet in this entire universe and get really interesting stories coming out of it, even if it's just delivered as like a text regurgitation or whatever. Like that's you could get really, really involved with one particular planet, you know? And so I'm always interested in like the balance of power with the Fets and the, or not the Fets, the Huts,
the Huts
rather.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Huts kind of crime family, and like how do they even rise to power, you know? Like I always get the sense in mafia movies that these made men were once scrappers back in their day and they can really hold their own on the street. But like, what can a Hut do at any point in their life?
Yeah. And you know what? I totally get the sense that the Hut family would be the people who you have to take like the initial loan out for to like finance universe expansion. And then you're on the hook for some like crazy compounding interest if you don't pay it off in time.
Wonder what they would even do if you don't pay it off, though.
Yeah, I think maybe they would start reclaiming planets. So they would start shrinking your empire. They'd be like, "This is where the Huts have taken back this planet, this planet, this planet." Or the Huts.
Maybe
like
you could borrow a bunch of money from like Jabba the Hutt and then just basically destroy Tatooine. And then, you know, maybe bounty hunters would be sent after you and you have to hire more Imperial guards. Maybe, I don't know what the repercussions could possibly be, but that would be a fascinating gamble to take.
I love the idea of treating either the Huts or even the Rebels as kind of a mechanic like the way SimCity treats natural disasters. Of like, yeah, the Rebels just came and blew up one of your bases on Yavin, you know. You're like, oh, these damn things, I can't do anything about it.
Right, we're out of time. Let's give it a name. It has to be Star Wars colon something.
It does, doesn't it? So there was strategy game, was Star Wars Empires at War, or Empire at War. I think it was Empires at War. Maybe there's like Star Wars Empire at Work.
I think that's so funny just for this little joke project.
Yeah.
I don't mind including that name. All right. Empire at Work. Thank you for that. I guess I'm just used to saying that phrase.
I leave you alone for 1 week.
I know. And I'm completely rusty on the other end of it. All right. Let's head over to our community. This is an email that comes from Joey Dyer, who says, "Hello, I'm a new listener and love the podcast. I'm constantly yelling out suggestions to the both of you on my commute.
Hey,
if we rode the same bus, then, you know, maybe we could, incorporate more of them into the show. But I do appreciate that you have started writing them out in emails. This is a very good step forward.
Yeah. And here's proof that that is the effective way to get us to respond.
Exactly. Yep. There we go. An idea I've had for a game involves a powerful wizard performing some sort of ritual to become the most powerful magic user in existence. But when reading the incantations for the ritual due to a typo, he ends up transforming himself into a lizard instead. I imagine the goal of the game would be to somehow find a way to undo the spell. You'd also unlock magic and/or reptilian abilities throughout the adventure. Anyway, thanks again for the great work. All right, Joey, this is a good one to start off on. Let's go ahead and start the clock there. I like the lizard wizard pun. It's a nice rhyming phrase there. I think it's a clever idea. I feel like it would be a point and click adventure game. What is the that series of point and click adventures starring a wizard? I think it was voiced by one of the Monty Python cast. Discworld series. It's a comedic point and click adventure game starring a wizard. I think that wizards are very at home in that type of environment, but of course we don't have to limit it to that. We have a world of possibilities in front of us. What do you make of this lizard transformation, you know, having to kind of balance these two aspects of yourself?
One thing in terms of video game fiction that I've always been fascinated by, because I'm generally fascinated by vampire fiction, good vampire fiction, not like the Twilight-y sort of schlock. And I'm generally, I've brought up this game before, the Legacy of Kain series.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the sort of in that universe is fiction, as vampires age and they grow more powerful, they become sort of more and more bat-like, both in their appearance. Their skin turns green, they get big, long, pointy ears, fangs, the whole thing, and then even eventually wings and that sort of thing. So I'm wondering if this is like, if there's an opportunity here to tell a story of the magic user who is becoming more and more powerful over ages and ages of time, and watching them, you know, only realize potentially once they're too far gone that they've created themselves or set themselves on a path to transforming their body and becoming this sort of not necessarily useless, but like impossible to communicate with a husk of a creature.
I like in the Dracula movie that came out in the 90s with Gary Oldman, Keanu Reeves. I like that Dracula would transform into these different animal forms. He'd be a giant kind of monster bat or a werewolf type of creature. And you got the sense that he could draw, of course, a lot of power from that, but he would lose a part of his sentience. And so maybe as you become more powerful as a snake, which you need for survival, you're kind of giving up aspects of your personhood. When you restore yourself, you lessen your capacity to learn magic or something like that. You know, I feel like that kind of long-term punishment for choices that you potentially make fairly early on feels kind of unfair, and it would lead, I think, most players to really kind of min-max their decisions to either go full snake or to go full wizard and never engage in the fun aspects of the other branch. So I'm not sure if I'm fully settled on that yet.
I've been tossing around this idea for a pitch, but it's kind of a half thought, and I wonder if it like plays well or is compatible with this, which is the idea of a skill tree being a true test of skill, where maybe you're playing a game as this magic user. In order to kind of get new skills, you have to partake in these challenges. And rather than like earning a skill point and spending that skill point, instead it's more like a challenge map or an isolated sort of combat challenge to be solved. And then what you could do is make the tree, if there's like, say, two trees, one of them is the lizard tree, one of them's the wizard tree. You could find that like they both demand a different sort of approach to combat to solve their problems. And maybe the lizard one is all about sort of aggression, and the wizard one is more about thoughtfulness and sort of hanging back and playing a little bit more defensively. But as you sort of push up those trees, you get that fable-like character transformation happening, and you start to see it physically manifest in yourself.
So what happens if you... Do you get to a point where you can never become a human wizard again? Maybe you always... Maybe you remain a wizard, or a lizard, rather. You just have magic abilities towards the end. I don't know. What is the goal that we're working towards here? Do we want to transform back into a human, or do we want to be the most powerful lizard alive?
That's a good question. I think that maybe what you could do is throughout the game, let's say there's a Dragon Age-like system built around this, interacting with people as you become more and more lizard, you start to you really start to scare people. You really start to become ostracized from society. People that you might need as resource vendors, or people who you might need as, or had at one point in your party as allies, abandon the lizard. And it's like a story of xenophobia in a way, but or lizard phobia, I guess, in a way. But likewise, the more you push up your skill tree, the more lizard-like you become. You're almost like Grundlefly from the Fly. So but that has its own benefits, right? You're growing stronger. You can potentially start to be able to walk on walls. You get like crazy new magic abilities that are beyond any of the magic users that you're facing in combat. But you yourself, like, it's kind of incentivizing you to try and do the run of the game where you pick up as few skills as possible, almost like that naked Dark Souls run.
Okay. So this could be kind of, you're working your way towards doing kind of a soul level one run of this. Maybe.
Yeah. That would be the pure human run.
I've always been curious about if you could kind of go through the game, not in any order necessarily, it has a linear progression, but if you can go back and then redo earlier sections better, kind of like in Lonely Mountain Downhill, oftentimes you're kind of racing against a clock, but the clock is your entire mountain from top to bottom run. But it's broken up between like five different checkpoint areas, and you're given a time for how long you did each checkpoint. You can try it and try and try and try again to get it through that checkpoint area as fast as possible. And I always wondered, if you got to the end and you were just a second over, if you could just go back to one section, redo that, shave a second off your time, and then get that victory. You know, maybe that would be an interesting way to take a kind of adventure-ish, Dark Souls-y kind of game where you could go back to earlier missions, try to get through with fewer aids along the way, and preserve more of that humanity. And so you're never too far gone. You can always go back and do it. It's just more difficult. Your skills have evolved as a player, and you can push yourself farther than you could at the time.
I like that idea. And I like the idea of kind of do we want to incentivize someone for being a little bad or subversive in that system? A person who wants to become the most powerful wizard of all time, as I'm reading the text, the initial pitch almost reads as like it was a mistake to become the lizard, right? Or it happens in an instant. And we've been talking about transformation in many ways. I wonder if there's like a way to hide the idea that you're becoming this thing, or sort of drop it on the player in a shocking moment.
You can always wear long cloaks. Maybe you have to do that as you go into town, like in Divinity Original Sin 2, when you play as one of the skeleton people, you have to wear a mask at all times. Otherwise, people will clock you as being a skeleton and become very scared of you.
Yeah, or you have to get, the outer... Outer Wilds, Outer Worlds has the sort of perception filter that you can put on yourself so that people don't know who you are for some period of time. So you have to kind of keep that spell going and have a constant mana drain while you're in these towns.
Right, we are past time there, so let's close it down, give it a name. There's so many, I mean, the wizard pun is right there, so... I mean, there's so many different directions. You're a lizard, Harry. Lizards of Waverly Place.
Oh, my God. You're a lizard, Harry.
Maybe if he is
What a terrible name for a video game protagonist, Harry.
You have a fun last name, you know?
Yeah, Harry. Yeah. I do kind of like it. Lizards of the Coast. We're kind of putting it in the title at this point that you're becoming a lizard. So the thought of hiding it from the player is now out the gate.
It could just be presented in a fun way.
I typed in wizards. You already got it. Wizards of Waverly Place. Wizard's Chest. Oh, Lizard's Chest is not bad.
The Lizard of Oz.
The Lizard of Oz. That actually feels good to say for whatever reason. The Washington Lizards. a lot of dumb stuff. I think you could also get away with just calling the damn thing Lizard, but put it in one of those wizardy fonts so it looks like a thing. But what did you say? I'll go with Lizards of Waverly Place or Lizards of the Coast. Or
I think your Lizard Harry is the strongest of the joke choices. Because it is just like somebody having to sit him down just explain it, like, you know what,
you can't,
there have been mistakes, can't,
make me laugh that good on these episodes, not yet. I'm gonna call Lambert, I'm gonna call Grim and send her your way.
All right, well, while you are dying of your cold, we would like to thank Joey Dyer for sending that one in. It's a tenuous connection at best, but anyways, that was emailed to us, playwrightcast@gmail.com. You can also go to our website, playwrightcast.com/pitch, to submit your own pitch. You can tweet us at playwrightcast, and in all of those instances, it is spelled PLAYWRITECAST.
Special thank you to Protodome for the use of our theme song, Hello World, off the album Blue Noise. And hey, quick shout out, I think it just dropped today. Congratulations to the small team who made Kentucky Route Zero for putting the rest of their
7 years
out.
Now.
Isn't that crazy?
That's dedication, and it's a very good game. I'm really looking forward to finishing it. Boy, it's going to be weird to not have that one on my backlog anymore.
Are you ready for this, H? I've never played it. I knew that it was something that I wanted to check out, but when I heard it was going to be finished at some point soon, which was like 2 years ago, I said, I'll wait till that last episode comes out. Now I need to go put my money where my mouth is, because
there's no more excuse.
I beat Control. I used my sickness as an excuse to beat Control, and I've got some bandwidth, so it's time to play some Kentucky Route Zero. We're not sponsored by them. I thought it was an amazing thing. So there it is.
That would be a strange sponsorship for them to make.
It would be, you know what? I don't think so. I think they would actually love to have that sponsorship. Contact us, Kentucky Reds. Okay. We'll make it happen.
No, I would love to sponsor the game. I would do it for half the price they would pay Giant Bomb.
Nay, a quarter of the price.
If only we could offer a quarter of the listeners.
Yes.
That's enough for today. Q, why don't you take us out with a miniature pitch?
You'll have to forgive me. You have dark thoughts when you're sick. But my pitch, my mini pitch, is a video game where you go around as a detective trying to uncover any piece of evidence that would convince Republicans to impeach the hell out of the president of the United States.
The problem is you could never present it, because they would, of course, vote against any evidence being presented.
Right. That's so too bad.
It's a lose-lose situation.
Yeah. Mm.
All right. Anyways, thanks for listening, everyone. We'll catch you again next week. We'll be in better health and in better spirits, hopefully.
No promises. Bye.